Well, again, the resolution reads, focus protection as set forth in the Great Barrington Declaration should be the general principle of public health management of highly infectious respiratory virus pandemics. Welcome not just to you in the audience, but to the scores of people who are watching this right now on live streaming. They, too, can vote yes, no, or undecided on the resolution, and we hope you do. We hope everybody votes. I also want to, again, invite you to the second mission of the SOHO Forum, not just to have debates of interest to the larger community, to libertarians in particular, but also to have a party, to have a place where people can meet and discuss the debate or discuss whatever else is on their mind. So if you bought a ticket to our reception afterwards, most of you probably know the location. Follow me, follow Nick, follow some of us just two blocks uptown where the party is being catered by my beautiful wife, Sacco, at our address at 55 Great Jones Street. Without any further delay, we bring you the main event of the evening. Arguing for the affirmative, Jay Bhattacharya. Jay, please come to the stage. Arguing for the negative, Sten Verman. Sten, please come to the stage. Okay, Jay Bhattacharya, you'll be watching the time. You probably want to take the podium, Jay. Sure. Probably take the podium for your talk, and you have 20 minutes to defend the resolution. Take it away, Jay.
Where is the clock?
The clock is down here.
Oh, perfect. Fantastic. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Gene, and thank you, Sten, for agreeing to debate. We are in an era where when we want to debate about COVID policy, we have people like the NIH director, Francis Collins, calling for devastating takedowns of the opposition. And in that era, it's really truly an honor to have someone like Sten to talk civilly about these issues of utmost importance, because this is not going to be the last pandemic that we face. And it's a very real possibility that the lockdown-focused policy that we used, a deviation from the norm for how we've dealt with respiratory virus pandemics in the past, will now become the new norm. And that so that throughout the rest of our lives, whenever there's a pandemic, the threat of what happened the last 3 years happening again and again and again will repeat itself. So the affirmative position talks about the Great Barrington Declaration. So let me just, if those of you in the room probably know what it is, but let me just tell you what it is. I'm one of the primary co-authors along with Martin Kulldorff of Harvard and Sunetra Gupta of Oxford University. It's based on two very simple scientific facts. First, in the context of COVID, there's a very steep age gradient in the risk profile of severe disease on infection with COVID. 80% of the deaths, something on that order, have occurred in people over the age of 65. And so an age is the primary risk factor, the most easily identifiable risk factor for COVID. There are other risk factors, diabetes, obesity, but they're not nearly as steep as age in as far as the risk of dying from infection. That's fact one. Fact two. The lockdowns themselves have been incredibly damaging to everybody. I'll talk through some of the harms, but I could spend my entire 20 minutes and not get anywhere near close to cataloging them, because they transform the lives of nearly every single human being. And for poor people around the world, they've been particularly devastating. For young people, for children, they've been devastating. So if you put these two facts together, COVID is a severe disease for older people, for younger people much less so. For the lockdowns are incredibly damaging. The lockdowns then impose an undue burden on the young, on people who are lower risk. And therefore, the first plank of the Great Barrington Declaration is to lift the lockdowns and never impose them again. The second plank, and probably equally important, is focused protection of the vulnerable and the older populations. And I'll talk a little bit about how we propose to do that during the pandemic ideas for how to do that in the next respiratory viral pandemic. Because this principle is generalizable, right? Those two planks, those two ideas are actually, although we don't know what the next respiratory viral pandemic will look like, we don't know yet what the risk factors are, we can use them to try to identify the risk factors. But what's the alternative? What's the alternative? Well, we just lived through one. We lived through this lockdown-focused strategy for managing the respiratory viral pandemic. It falls on me to define what a lockdown is. A lot of times I come in and say, like, people ask me what it is. The idea of a lockdown, in my view, is any policy designed to prevent people from breathing in the vicinity of one another or touching one another. Any policy designed to prevent people breathing on one another or touching one another. So this includes, for instance, the mass quarantine of large numbers of healthy people, shelter-in-place orders, business closures, church and mosque and synagogue closures, closures of schools. All of that count as lockdown, obviously. But it also includes strategies like, in the UK, employing propaganda techniques explicitly by the government to spew fear in the population. In the US, strong recommendations to social distance, to stay away from other people, to treat everybody else as a biohazard. Right? That, in my view, is a lockdown. And the tools to enforce it include both propaganda tools and, as well, wide-scale censoring, smearing, and demeaning of people who oppose it, including people with credentials to speak up. So that's one alternative, right, what we just experienced, to focus protection. The other alternative is to let the virus rip, to essentially do nothing, let older populations die, and hope the disease just goes away. While that sounds inhumane, it is inhumane. In some very poor parts of the world, the capacity to do anything else is really not in place, and the attempt to do lockdown has done incredible harm. So those are the two alternatives that we're talking about, and I think both Sten and I can agree that let it rip is not the right alternative. That if it's possible to do something to protect vulnerable people, we must do that. It's an ethical must. So with that in mind, the two alternatives are focused protection and lockdown. The failure of COVID response is all around us. And it's really important to understand why the lockdowns failed. And I can just tell you this with a couple of simple data points. In the early days when the lockdowns were imposed in Toronto, Canada, if you look at the graph of where the cases spread, and they spread despite the lockdowns there, in the 30 poorest neighborhoods, there was an enormous spread of cases. In the 30 richest neighborhoods, almost none. The same thing happened in Los Angeles. All through 2020, if you look at the age-adjusted mortality and age-adjusted case rates from COVID in Los Angeles, it's the poorest neighborhoods where the disease spread, and the richest neighborhoods, much less so. It's the communities where ethnic minorities lived where the disease spread. It's the communities where white populations lived where it didn't in Los Angeles. The lockdowns are not, people are not uniformly capable of coping with lockdowns. They are a luxury of the rich. The lockdowns are a luxury of the rich, and a specific kind of rich. They're a luxury of the laptop class. In the United States, something like 20% of the population could afford to do a lockdown without losing their jobs, without fearing a loss of livelihood. That's not true for most of the population, in fact. It's not humanely possible to do something like what China is attempting over an extended period of time without civil rights violations on a wide scale that harm the poorest, the most vulnerable, the working class populations the most. And eventually, and pretty soon, most of the population, except for the laptop class, will not be able to comply with the lockdowns. We need to be in community with one another. We're built for that kind of community. And asking people for an extended period of time to stay out of that community is inhumane and is bound to fail and cause great damage in the meantime. The lockdowns, the harms of the lockdowns were tremendous. The closed schools were seeing deep learning loss, especially in the communities that locked down the highest. It's poor families that were unable to replace the education, the actually lack of education the Zoom school represented, that have faced the worst of the learning losses. We have created a generational inequality that will take tremendous effort to address if it's at all possible to do so. And it's not just that there's learning loss. The evidence from before the pandemic on the importance of school suggests that these learning losses have long consequences in the lives of our children. One estimate for early in the pandemic suggested the spring closures alone cost our children 5.5 million life years. Why? Because when children don't go to school, it turns out for even short periods of time, they lead poorer, shorter, less healthy lives, which is what we decided when we decided to close the schools. Harm to poor countries are even more. Tremendous effect on poverty. So we globalized the world over the last 40 years. We systematically dropped trade barriers, created this global system, and poor countries reorganized their economies to fit in. When we locked down, when we broke supply chains, the pointy end of that were poor people in informal sectors in poor countries, 100 million extra people thrown into poverty as a consequence of the lockdown, tens of millions of people on the brink of starvation. In March of 2021, the UN issued a report suggesting that 238,000 children had died from starvation caused by the economic dislocation of the lockdowns. And it's not just the lockdowns imposed in the poor countries. It's the Western lockdowns, which had ripple effects on the economies of the poor countries. The lockdowns were bound to fail because the disease spread even before we knew it. In the early days of the pandemic, I did a study of the prevalence of the disease in Santa Clara County and also in Los Angeles County. It was roughly 3 or 4% was the prevalence we found. I mean, that's a big number, actually. 3 or 4%, it was much higher than the number of people that had been identified as cases. The disease had arrived and spread in the United States long before we knew it. There are antibody studies from blood banks in stored blood from Angola, from Italy, from October of 2019, suggesting that perhaps the disease was already seeded then. It was, by the time the lockdowns arrived, it was too late. And that will be true in the next pandemic as well. We do not have surveillance systems that allow us to guarantee picking up a highly infectious respiratory virus pandemic before it starts. The focus protection as a general pandemic plan is actually not even a novel idea, right? We use this standard pandemic plan in a century of respiratory virus pandemics, 1957, 1968, 1976, something like focus protection, even 2009. We did not lock down despite widespread deadly respiratory virus pandemics. Woodstock happened during a pandemic. The identification of risk factors regarding who's at highest risk and poor, in the case of COVID, is age. It may be something else in the next pandemic. So it's hard to say, let's follow exactly these policies. But the principle of focus protection, identifying who's highest risk, moving heaven and earth to protect them, while not disrupting the rest of society, is a principle that we can apply very generally. Focus protection is necessarily a local task. It requires creativity at the local level. During this pandemic, what it required was that people, local public health officials who know how older people live in their communities, engage creatively, think of ideas to protect the community members as they live there. The policies followed in Billings, Montana are certain to be very different than the right policies to follow in Los Angeles or in Stockholm. Just to give an example of this, of things that we could have done but didn't, in Los Angeles, hotel rooms during the pandemic were provided to homeless populations, which is fine, but they weren't provided to elderly people living in multi-generational homes, often poor Hispanic populations. When someone, you know, Johnny comes home or calls grandma, says, "Grandma, I think I've been exposed to COVID," grandma could have called local public health, and a hotel room provided until Johnny was cleared, right? Those kinds of ideas could have been used at scale for the trillions of dollars we spent, but they weren't because we didn't creatively decide to protect vulnerable older people, instead relying on lockdowns to control community spread instead, which obviously failed. The protection of hospital systems it was a main argument for lockdowns. The problem is that you actually don't need to lock down to protect hospital systems. Focused protection does the job. Who's at highest risk for hospitalization? Well, it's older people. If you protect older people, well, you reduce the burden on hospital systems. Hospital systems, and there's not just demand-side policies, there's also supply-side policies. We rapidly built facilities to manage patients for overflow in New York, in Los Angeles, in Santa Clara, in San Francisco, and actually all of those facilities went unused. You know, the Javits Center, the Mercy Ship, and so on. What's the upshot of this? The upshot is that if you do a policy of lockdown, of trying to suppress the spread of the disease, or to protect hospital systems, you essentially split goals. And this is a world filled with trade-offs. Why did Andrew Cuomo send COVID-infected patients back to nursing homes? Why did that happen in Stockholm? Why did that happen in Montreal? Why did that happen in Pennsylvania? It happened because instead of focused protection of vulnerable people being the goal, we instead decided the protection of hospital systems was the goal. If instead we decided that focused protection of older people who were at highest risk were the goal, we could have done what happened, for instance, in Florida, of quarantine hospitals, quarantine centers, intermediate between nursing homes and hospitals where COVID-infected patients were sent to convalesce before they were sent back to hospitals, before nursing homes. What's the end point of all this? The end point is immunity. This is something that early in the pandemic it was taboo to say. If you get COVID and recover, you do get immunity. Now, this is a coronavirus. The kind of herd immunity that you get is very different than the kind of herd immunity that you would get from measles. Measles, you get measles and you recover, and you're going to have immunity forever against getting measles again. With this virus, what happens is you get COVID, you recover, and you can get COVID again, especially if there's new variants, but what seems likely, and it's just like it's true with the other coronaviruses, the second time you get it, it's going to be less severe than the first time. That's not a guaranteed ironclad rule, but it's likely. And that plays out in epidemiological data all over the place. So the end point is herd immunity. That has always been the end point. We have no technology to protect any population forever from a highly infectious respiratory virus. We have no technology to protect any population forever, except maybe someone like Howard Hughes, you know, stick up in his mansion. The end point then is immunity. Even focused protection can't be permanent. The idea is to protect older people until you develop better ways to treat the disease, better ways to vaccinate, better ways to manage the disease. Very quickly in the pandemic, for instance, we learned that steroids were a very effective way to manage patients in the hospital. We didn't know that at the beginning. A focused protection strategy, until we started to learn about the disease, is a way to reduce the net harm from the disease, because then the most vulnerable people get the disease last. I want to finish with some ethical principles of public health that I think were violated during the pandemic that are consistent with focused protection but not consistent with lockdown. And I'll just read from that. This is something that I wrote with some of my colleagues. One, all public health advice should consider the impact on overall health rather than solely be concerned with a single disease. It should always consider the benefits and harms from public health measures and weigh the short term versus the long term. This is exactly what focused protection does. It considers the whole person rather than, and doesn't just say that the only harm to our health is COVID. In fact, there are many, many threats to our health of the population. People who are not vulnerable to COVID are vulnerable to many other things. Two, public health is about everyone. Any public health policy must first and foremost protect society's most vulnerable, including children, low-income families, persons with disability, and the elderly. It should never shift the burden of disease from the affluent to the less affluent, which is exactly what focused protection did. A trickle-down epidemiology policy where the theory, where lockdowns are trickle-down epidemiology policy, where the idea is that if we protect the super the laptop class, everyone else is protected. 3, public health advice should be adapted to the needs of each population within cultural, religious, geographic, and other contexts. If you believe that church is vital, is essential, if you believe that synagogues are essential, that mosques are essential, then they are, and public health needs to acknowledge that. 4, public health is about comparative risk evaluations, risk reductions, and reducing uncertainties using the best available scientific evidence, since risk cannot usually be entirely eliminated. That idea that we have to live with risk, that there is no perfect, there's only trade-offs, is central to public health, and it's something that the public was misled about during the pandemic. 5, public health requires public trust. Public health recommendations should present facts as the basis for guidance and never employ fear or shame or sway to manipulate the public. And I should say, the public health should always eschew noble lies. Noble lies undermine trust in public health. 6, medical interventions should not be forced or coerced on a population, but rather should be voluntary and based on informed consent. Public health officials are advisors, not rule setters, and provide information and resources for individuals to make informed decisions. 7, public health authorities must be honest and transparent, both with what is known and with what is not known. Advice should be evidence-based and explained by data. Authorities must acknowledge errors and changes in evidence as soon as they are made aware of them. We should not have people in charge of public health who believe that they are science itself. 8, three more guys. Public health scientists and practitioners should avoid conflicts of interest, and any unavoidable conflicts of interest must be clearly stated. That's been a problem through the pandemic. Both pharmaceutical companies and as well public health officials who control research budgets also being deeply involved in public health policy setting. 9, in public health, open civilized debate is profoundly important. What we're doing here is vital. And it's unacceptable for public health professionals to censor, silence, or intimidate members of the public or other public health scientists or practitioners, which has happened during the pandemic. And last one, and I'll be all done. It's critical for public health scientists and practitioners always to listen to the public, who are living with the public health consequences of public health decisions, and to adapt appropriately. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Stan Verman, you get one extra minute for your presentation because Jay took one extra minute. It's okay.
Thank you, Jay. Very articulate, very inspiring. But we're going to have a difference of opinion this evening. So public health is many things. And what we're talking about tonight is communicable disease control. That is one tiny sliver of public health. But there are others, for example, the environment, toxic waste dumps, the world of social and behavioral science, the social determinants of disease. And we're all in it together. So the fundamental truth in public health, especially for communicable diseases, is that there is a social compact. As much as we would like to be valuing individual liberty all the time, everywhere, if there is an active tuberculosis patient or individual on the subway and that individual is coughing, that individual may very well infect people around him or her. And every state in the union has a law that permits public health officials to actually lock up such a person because of the weight of burden on the public's health. We violate the individual liberty of that individual to go free. We know that Typhoid Mary spent substantial time in a local island when she refused to give up her career as an itinerant cook, because she was infecting her patients, at least apocryphally she was. And we have many other examples of where infectious agents that cannot be controlled are subject to things like isolation and all the rest. So let's turn back the clock to February 28th, I think it was 2020, where a CDC official who's now the dean of the Jillings School of Public Health at UNC, Dr. Messonnier, announced that we were in trouble. She was the head of respiratory diseases at CDC at the time, and that we were going to have to mobilize to control what seemed to be a global pandemic, because we had seen the devastation in Wuhan, China, the deaths in that city in December, January of that year, and we were seeing deaths now in Europe, Italy, and elsewhere. And she predicted that this would come to the U.S. She was promptly shut down by the White House at that time, and you barely heard from her the rest of the pandemic. It was politicized that early. And the reality was, she was absolutely right. I had two friends die in early 2020. Dr. Gita Ramji, an immensely talented reproductive health expert, world-renowned. Dr. James Hakim, world expert in HIV disease. They both died. They were both in their early 60s. Neither of them had any risk factors. So I was alarmed by the loss of friends of mine, and I was alarmed by the magnitude of the pandemic. Yes, we have pandemics quite routinely, 1957, 1968. Even in the 21st century, we have had pandemic flu. The differential between an average flu season and a pandemic flu season is about 10,000 to 50,000. Now, we've had 1 million people die of coronavirus in the span of about 2 years. So the magnitude of what we were up against in the early 2020 time period was completely unlike anything that we'd experienced for a century. You have to go back to so-called Spanish flu of 1918-1919, a bit of a misnomer. Spain didn't have censorship of their newspapers because they were not combatants in World War I. So that was the only newspaper pool in Europe that actually reported influenza at the time, because everybody else suppressed it. In any case, that was probably 40% worse than COVID, and many times worse than any other pandemic threat. So it was a unique time in 2020. Many of you lived through it here in New York City. I lived through it in Connecticut. We were hit hard very early, and we were filling up our hospitals with dead and dying patients. In Yale New Haven Hospital, it's the second largest hospital in the United States, with over 1,500 beds. We had 450 patients in our hospital at that in April of 2020, and we had 143 deaths that month, which was astronomical for a hospital of that sophistication. To have an unknown disease come into the hospital, we had to open up three new floors to accommodate the ICU beds. Many of our doctors didn't go home for 3, 4, 5 weeks at a time because they were afraid of infecting their families, and they were needed in the hospital. The stress was absolutely mind-boggling. Now, this is with a fairly aggressive lockdown policy. But my distinguished opponent would lead you to believe that if we had done much less, we would have been much better off. And I maintain that when we had a pandemic respiratory virus of this magnitude, that we didn't know what we were up against. We hadn't seen this in 100 years. So we needed to deploy many different layers of protection to see if we could put a stop to it. This included masking, this included physical distancing, it included lockdowns, it included hygiene, it included reform of HVAC systems and improving indoor air quality, pivoting to outdoor activities, and all the things you're very familiar with. Now, when we think about so-called protecting the vulnerable, the entire backbone of the focused protection scheme. We have no plan for such a thing. We have 4% of the population in the United States that is immunosuppressed, and only about half of those people know that they're immunosuppressed. Furthermore, we have vast populations in our nursing homes. In the state of Connecticut, there are about 17,500 people in nursing homes. And in 2020, we had 3,500 of them die. That was a 20% mortality rate. And in reality, we didn't have any provision for focused protection. There was no pool of empty hotel rooms to transfer the nursing home patients to. There was no workforce that we could deploy so that people working in nursing homes could not have two jobs and could just be resting in place in one nursing home. We had no real plan for such a respiratory disease of that magnitude. Hence, the lockdowns were essentially a desperation measure, essentially something that we did as the rates were skyrocketing to try to reach an asymptote and start dropping them. By May of 2020, in the state of Connecticut, we had a Reopen Connecticut Task Force report describing how we could end the lockdowns, which we largely did in later that year. We also were able to reopen our schools. There was only one major school district in the state that did not reopen in the autumn. So that Jay and I see eye to eye on the merits of using radical public health measures as briefly as possible. But Jay would have done something that he has not defined for us. He talks about focused protection, but we have heard nothing about how he would identify the immunosuppressed people and keep them safe, how he would segregate all of the elderly people in the United States from all the rest of us and let the virus sweep through the rest of us. We would pay a price. We would have a few children die. There have been 680 children who've died of COVID in the United States the last time I checked. We would have young people die, like my friends who were in their early 60s. We would have people even younger die. And we would sweep through the population, tolerate those deaths, and magically segregate our elderly and our immunosuppressed. Well, we don't know how to do that. We have no plan to do that. We have no financing to do that, and we couldn't have done that. So focused protection, in my view, is a pipe dream. It's a theoretical concept that sounds appealing on a debate stage, but the reality of what we were up against in public health was a surging pandemic of an unprecedented virus that we had not seen its like since the pandemic influenza of 1918, 1919, which was of somewhat comparable level. Everything that Jay has said about the harms of lockdowns, I understand. I worked tirelessly to try to keep schools open in the state of Connecticut. I worked even with Rhode Island, with schools here in New York City, schools in California, and trying my best as a pediatrician and infectious disease epidemiologist to combine my skill set to try to keep children in school. So I sympathize completely with the harms that excessive lockdowns or unreasonable policies resulted. On the other hand, I absolutely feel that focused protection is not a defined concept. There is only one place that I'm aware that they tried this at a national scale, and that's the country of Sweden. So in Sweden, typically you think about Sweden, my parents' home country of Norway, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, in the same breath. You think, well, similar policies, great deal of coordination. That usually is true. But in this case, Sweden took a very different position because of the point of view of its head epidemiologist, and they adopted a focused protection scheme. So pregnant women had four times the hospitalization rate for COVID in Sweden than any of the other Scandinavian countries. There were 14.3 excess deaths per 100,000 population in Sweden in 2020 versus no excess deaths in Denmark and Norway. There was a full capacity surge and crisis in Swedish hospitals by December of 2020. There was no such crisis in the rest of Scandinavia. There was case rates 7.8 per 1,000 in Sweden and between 1.4 and 2.4 per 1,000 in Norway, Denmark, and Finland, almost a 3.5-fold excess. Test positivity rates in Sweden were 9.7%. They were between 1% and 2% in Norway, Denmark, and Finland. And deaths in Sweden from COVID were 11.5 times greater than in Norway, 5.1 times greater than in Denmark, and 9.1 times greater than in Finland. Furthermore, what the Swedes were trying to do, which is preserve their economy, didn't work either. And Irfan et al. Were publishing just a few months ago in the Journal of Global Health, saw that there was no trade-off between the economy and public health. In other words, the Swedes suffered as much economic loss as the Norwegians and Danes did because, frankly, it was a global catastrophe, a global pandemic crisis. So the borders were being closed, something the Swedes couldn't do anything about. I could go on and on about Sweden, but it was the Swedes themselves that recognized what a catastrophic approach they had taken. And in November of 2020, they established a distancing and isolation policy, which started to mimic what we had done much earlier in the year. Now, I give this to you as a natural experiment. A natural experiment is where you don't randomize countries and say, well, we'll randomize Sweden over here and everybody else over there. But it just happened that they had a different policy. But the cultures and the background populations are so similar across these countries that reasonable epidemiologists conclude that it was the Swedish policy of so-called focused protection that did not work and that ended up with this kind of crisis circumstance. I'll also mention a few of the points that Jay highlighted, and we call each other by our first names because we know each other, having debated twice before. The issue of the age gradation of COVID. Is that 5 seconds or 5 minutes? Minutes, thank you. So age gradation of COVID. Flu typically is worse in the very young and the very old. So my age group, as a pediatrician, the under twos, and the geriatrician's age group. The pandemic influenza of 1918 and 1919 actually disproportionately hit people of middle age, and it was also influenza. Now, COVID, in the SARS example and in the MERS example, both COVID viruses of quite devastating capacity that hit us in 2003-2004 was SARS, and then in about 2009 to about 2017, MERS, the Middle East respiratory. Those are both serious coronaviruses that have higher infection fatality rates than COVID does. But they're not as infectious, and SARS afflicted 8,000 people as opposed to tens of millions of people, probably hundreds of millions of people around the world. So there are different circumstances. But the reason I mention it is all of them have different age groups that are being afflicted. So we didn't know the degree to which we were dealing with a virus that was sort of excessive in the elderly, nor if we had known, because we knew that sort of by summer, but if we had known that even earlier, we probably couldn't have done anything about it, because the point that Jay made was there was no way to extract the elderly from the households. There was no way to shut down our nursing homes and magically disperse them. There was no way to identify the immunosuppressed people who hadn't been diagnosed yet. So it was a collective decision and a collective goal to try to reduce transmission in the general population and thereby protect the most vulnerable among us. I don't think that was unreasonable. Even, I think, a libertarian would not see that as unreasonable, as long as it's being managed in an intelligent way, which it wasn't always managed in an intelligent way. I'll give my distinguished opponent that point. Now, I would also like to make the issue of the lockdowns being damaging and an undue burden on the young. This I find to be a paradoxical statement, because we're talking about the death of the elderly, the death of the immunosuppressed. We're talking about very serious consequences of a pandemic respiratory disease for which we had no treatments, for which we had no vaccines. And that should have been our focus and was our focus. And that young people suffered is a very unfortunate side effect. But the best circumstances were the ones in which lockdowns were transient, safe reopening was made feasible, remediation of building air systems was made possible, separation was possible, say separating children 3 to 6 feet in schools, masking was encouraged, etc. And in safe reopening, we, I think, had the best of both worlds. We were able to protect the vulnerable in a time of extreme crisis. And as treatments, as vaccines came on board, until that time, we were able to keep much of our population safe. So I don't believe that undue burden on the young is a good argument. I also feel that the harms of closures does not logically lead to the focused protection strategy. I would ask in rebuttal if my distinguished opponent would tell us how he would propose to disperse the vulnerable elderly into safe, isolated zones. Because that's functionally what focused protection is. Alternatively, one could group them into camps and have all the vulnerable people together, which I think as a public health professional, I think is a very bad idea. One person getting in, you have a wildfire within that environment. So let's get specific, Jay. Tell us what focused protection is. Tell us how you would operationalize it. And since we were not in a position to do that in March, April, May of 2020, why what we did was so terrible. Thank you.
Want to take the podium? 5 minutes of rebuttal. Take it away, Jay.
5 minutes, right? Thank you, Sten. So there's a few points that Sten make I wanted to focus a little bit on. So first, Sten mentioned the harm from the pandemic, million people dead in the United States with COVID. And I agree. But the problem was that we did not take the disease seriously enough. Contrary to what Sten said, we actually knew from the earliest days of the pandemic about the age gradient. There was a ship, the Diamond Princess cruise, where almost every single death was people, older people. The data out of China told us from the earliest days of the pandemic that it was older people that were highest risk. And we did not take that signal strongly enough. We didn't move heaven and earth to protect the people that are most vulnerable. Instead, relying on lockdown. Sten mentioned the trauma of seeing patients die. I've seen from my colleagues at Stanford the same. A lot of doctors were quite afraid of treating COVID patients because it was an unknown disease. And the trauma, they described to me the trauma of seeing patients die. I agree with that. The problem is that this trauma led to bad policy. In fact, the dean of Stanford Medicine told me when I asked him if we could have a debate like this in 2020, he said that it was too early to have a dispassionate academic discussion about policy, because people were still too traumatized from the experience in March. The panic that led to the lockdown meant that the lockdowns could not be transient. The panic fueled more panic, and into 2020 and 2021, we adopted policies designed to treat each other as biohazards. It's not possible to have a transient lockdown without panicking the population, as we've learned through this pandemic. It also leads to the adoption of non-evidence-based policies, right? So why did public health tell you that wearing cloth masks would protect you when there was literally no evidence that was true? That very likely led to deaths because people who were vulnerable wore a cloth mask, went out in public when they were not protected from the disease, even though they thought they were. So the idea that lockdown adopted in panic is the right approach, I don't agree with. Sten asked for a plan for focus protection. That's completely reasonable. The plan I'd call for, and I mentioned during my talk, is for local public health to engage creatively with the living circumstances of the ill. I do not support segregating old people into camps. If someone, when I'm 85 and my grandson or granddaughter comes up to me and gives me a hug, even though there's a pandemic on, I'm gonna hug them, even if I'm at high risk. I want to preserve that possibility. But you can adopt policies to not send COVID-infected patients to nursing homes, right? Because you're not protecting, who are you protecting? You're trying to protect hospitals, I guess? You can adopt policies to make resources available. There were a lot of hotel rooms available. And we spent $6 trillion. What was lacking was creative thinking about how to apply focus protection in local communities. So I think the straw man argument of camps for grandmas is not focus protection. That treats health as if only infectious disease control is synonymous with health. It's not. Finally, Sweden. The statistics that you got from Sten on Sweden actually were 2020 statistics. In 2020, Sweden failed to protect older people. In Stockholm, they sent COVID-infected patients back to nursing homes, causing a tremendous death. That was not focused protection. What they got right was keeping schools open. In fact, through the pandemic, the kids under 15 all went to school in Sweden. Norway, which closed schools for a short time, actually apologized to the population for having done so, because it was an enormous mistake, which I think Sten will agree with. So I think it's to characterize Swedish outcomes as bad is actually really, really not right. If you look through the pandemic, they have lower all-cause excess deaths than Finland, roughly the same as Norway, roughly the same as Denmark, and much lower than the rest of Europe. In fact, the Swedish experience turned out to be quite good. In November 2020, they did adopt a slightly more harsh policy, in that they recommended social distancing when the disease was spreading rapidly, which is completely consistent with focused protection, especially if you make that recommendation to older people and tell people who's really at highest risk. So I think practically, focused protection can work. It requires creativity. It requires deployment of resources, and it requires not panicking. On the other hand, lockdown, we've seen it fail. It'll fail again. It'll cause all the harms that I've mentioned before, again and again, until we decide as a community, as a nation, as a world to reject it. Thank you.
The Swedish experience was very good. I don't know many professionals who would agree with that. The statistics don't lie, and in 2020, the Swedes were with nine times the death rates of neighbors. It was a grim circumstance. What they did was they changed their policy. What they did was they instituted precisely some of this separation and cautionary notes. You saw masks go on in Sweden in public places. You saw small groups being banned. They were not allowed to have groups bigger than a certain amount. All the same things we did at Yale University. And that is why circumstances improved in Sweden, not because focused protection was working, but it was actually not working, and they had to back away from that strategy. Jay and I actually agree on the issues of schools, and I think I mentioned in my comments that I spent a good part of my 2020-2021 working with schools to help keep them open safely. I did the same with arts organizations like the Sheen Center to try to help them reopen, etc. So I do agree with Jay that that we could do much better with a middle ground, not absolute lockdown all the time, months after month after month, not overreacting. So in that sense, as is sometimes the case in debates, one sees common ground. But the lockdowns, as far as I'm concerned, we really had no alternative. We had dying patients. We didn't have plans. We were desperate to stem the unremittingly grim march of mortality and incidence, filling our hospitals, filling our ICUs, overwhelming our health system. And if there's one thing about a respiratory disease that we know, is that you can reduce its transmission if you keep people apart. I am aware of the laptop argument. White-collar workers had a much easier time keeping their jobs and working from home than blue-collar workers did. There's no question that blue-collar workers were disadvantaged and were in a position where they might put themselves in harm's way. And the social determinants of disease predate the COVID pandemic and will be here after the COVID pandemic is less of a public health emergency because the United States spends a disproportionate amount of money on its health system and not enough on its social system. So we have no problem taking a homeless individual in the hospital for diabetic ketoacidosis or asthma and suboptimally placing them in a community because the hospital doesn't have housing stock. And at the end of the day, we coordinate that extremely poorly. And this is one of the reasons we have the highest expenditures for health of any high-income country in the world with some of the worst outcomes. Because we've got distorted a view of what we're going to spend money on. We won't house a homeless person, but we will spend whatever it takes to treat them in a hospital. It makes no sense. It's not what the Europeans do. And I think that that laptop story is not unique to COVID. It's universal in all of our circumstances. I do think that that lockdowns in informed constituencies were transient. They weren't as bad in the state of Connecticut as Jay would have you believe. We did have a plan to reopen the state in 2020. We did operationalize that plan, and I think we mitigated some of the social harms. Now, cloth masks, I think we could talk about all night, because two-ply cloth masks did okay with the ancestral strain. Didn't do as well with Delta, didn't do as well with Omicron. But I think when there was a shortage of surgical masks, KN95 masks, cloth masks were a clever idea. That's what I said in the article I wrote in March of 2020. Thank you.
Thanks to you both. We now go to the Q&A portion of the evening, and it does consist of questions from the audience. You can line up and ask questions. It also consists of you, either side, having the option to ask the other a question at any time, exercising that option. It also includes moderator's prerogative. Let me start a little bit with moderator's prerogative, if you'll permit me. Question for Jay and for Stan to comment. Stan mentioned immunosuppressed people. You speak about the age gradient, but then you also concede that there are other vulnerable people. Is that the immunosuppressed people difficult to recognize, and how would you deal with that with focused protection?
So it's, immunosuppression is a complicated question. So, for instance, there's a study out of France that suggests that immunosuppressed children did no worse with COVID than non-immunosuppressed children. I don't think that result holds for adults, but the reaction to COVID, whether you're high risk or not, is an empirical question. And because you're immunosuppressed doesn't automatically make you high risk. It just depends. It's a hard question. I mean, I completely grant you. I don't think the lockdowns did a very good job protecting those populations, especially those who don't know they're immunosuppressed. I don't know if any policy that would protect them from that. So I think it's a difficult question, and there's really not a fantastic answer that I can give you. You have to work with the data you have. Age is a risk factor. We knew that early on. Diabetes is a risk factor. We knew that early on. Work with those, the things that you know, and work really hard to learn more so that the degree of ignorance is less. And really, there's no other alternative. It's a world, unfortunately, filled with trade-offs. Immunosuppressed people know that they're at risk even from other infectious diseases, not just COVID. So in that sense, they have a leg up. The ones who don't know, it's really just a very difficult challenge for everything.
Comment from you, Stan, or you want to, no?
There's a...
Yeah, go ahead.
I think, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I think there is Jay is absolutely right. There's a substantial diversity in the pool of the 4% of us who are immunosuppressed. Someone can be battling cancer and taking immunosuppressed drugs, be profoundly immunosuppressed, be at very high risk of what we sometimes call opportunistic infections, of which COVID could be one, coronavirus could be one. And then there are people who are mildly immunosuppressed. So there is heterogeneity in that pool. But I think it's well understood that folks who are elderly, folks who are immunosuppressed, folks with diseases that are associated with immunosuppression, such as diabetes, were at higher risk.
Question for Stan, and then from the moderator. You mentioned the nursing homes, and with respect to, and then also there's old people live alone, or two old people live alone. I would have thought that the one thing about nursing homes that makes focus protection simple is that one thing you don't do is what the Swedes do, or what Cuomo did. You don't send infected people to the nursing homes. The nursing homes are already isolated, so you just make sure you seal them and protect them in different ways. So one would assume that that's a fairly simple solution for focus protection. And secondly, you also have old people who live alone, and so you get them the groceries. And then you have the third kind, the multigenerational, and Jay said different solutions for them. But in the nursing homes and the old people live alone, a fairly simple focus protection policy available for them?
Well, 20% of them in the state of Connecticut died in the year 2020.
Well, they weren't protected, probably.
They weren't protected, and we had no plan to protect them.
Well, that's the other question. You say,
are you going to let me answer, or do you want to keep asking questions?
I apologize. Go ahead.
So my point is that we were poorly capacitated. And if, as a public health academic who used to work in the public sector in public health, I'm happy to look at a mirror and criticize, because there was no anticipation of this magnitude of respiratory disaster, even though the CDC in 2017 had rewritten its guidelines for pandemic prevention, and most of those recommendations were completely ignored. During the Obama administration, we learned how to make KN95 masks by the millions. We learned how to make affordable ventilators that could be produced, but we didn't make the masks and we didn't make the ventilators. We just prepared for it. So you come to March, April, May, we don't have care for the nursing home people, putting them in empty hotel rooms. It doesn't exist. We don't have a plan. And what happened was, again, the social determinants of disease. The wealthiest nursing homes had the better paid employees who did not have to go to their second job and did not have to mix across nursing homes. It was a social disaster, because the poorer you were, the more that you were a person of color, the more likely you were to die in a nursing home. The richer you were, the whiter you were, the less likely you were going to die. So it was that context in which we couldn't snap our fingers and created focused protection. It was not possible, and therefore we had lockdowns.
I want you to comment, but I just want to ask a follow-up question. You speak perhaps very understandably about the problems of the past, but we, of course, are looking to the future. So wouldn't you say then that for the future, focused protection of that kind can be put in place for the nursing homes?
If we did that, we would be doing something extraordinary. It will take an awful lot of investment, and we aren't good at investing in public health. Our health care system has all sorts of perverse incentives for us to invest in care. That comes through our insurance schemes. $1 in $3 of the American dollar goes to insurance companies, ballooning our costs, and public health is paid through tax dollars, through different schemes, and we vastly underinvest in public health. So if we had commensurate investments in public health so that we had a plan to relocate 17,500 nursing home patients in Connecticut nursing homes on in the space of 2 weeks into protected circumstances like empty hotel rooms, and we had people to care for them, but that's a bit of a pipe dream at the present time.
You isolate the people in nursing homes, but you want to comment.
Just a couple of comments. One is what Sen is talking about, and he's right, is that there's that five-star nursing homes did better at protecting the residents than lower-quality nursing homes. You can't overnight turn one-star nursing homes into five-star nursing homes. What you can do is recognize that one-star nursing homes are at risk and not send COVID-infected patients back to them. The idea isn't to, like, take all 17,500 residents' nursing homes out of nursing homes and put them in hotel rooms to isolate them. The idea is to move resources to protect the nursing homes where they are, not put them at heightened risk, right? So, for instance, we knew very early on that nursing home employees who worked in multiple nursing homes are tracking COVID into multiple nursing homes. That's a policy that could easily have been changed. We spent $6 trillion. We could have paid nursing home staff to stay on campus for 2 weeks at a time and not go back in and out. It would have taken creativity. It would have taken thought, not trillions of dollars, although we did spend trillions. If we spent it more wisely in the service of focused protection, we could have protected those nursing home patients much better. It wouldn't not have been perfect. Anyone that tells you that is lying to you. But it could have been much better.
The option to ask each other a question right now, or do you want to put it to the audience? Either one?
Well, since I agree with what Jay just said, I don't need to ask him a question.
No question for you, Jay, to Stan.
No, yes.
Okay. Question, sir. Please ask a question as a question, and only one question. And unfortunately, there's no follow-up.
Well, regarding Sweden, in a Tom Woods newsletter that came out a few days ago, he published a graph on excess deaths released by the Organization for Economic Cooperation. And it does say that Sweden had 1,800 deaths per million, and Norway had 600. But in terms of total excess death percentages, Sweden's only 6.7 and Norway is 6.9. Those are puzzling numbers. And do you feel that either one is more significant than the other, the total excess deaths or the raw number per million?
Stan, do you want to answer that? And then Jake, comment.
There are some subtle differences in the age distribution of Sweden and Norway. Norwegians live a little bit longer than Swedes, and there are a somewhat higher proportion of elderly in Norway. So there are many other reasons why Norwegians might die from non-COVID reasons at higher rates. So one would have to age standardize those data to have a fair comparison. And I think the COVID data speak for themselves.
So the John Ioannidis and Mike Levitt, who's a Nobel Prize winner at Stanford, and John Ioannidis is a colleague of mine at Stanford, did a very extensive study of all-cause excess deaths with age standardization. The Scandinavian countries come out pretty close to each other near the top of Europe. All-cause excess death is the right measure because it looks and says, okay, we've adopted these policies, what happened all the way across? There is no perfect example of focused protection anywhere. No country did it perfectly. I'll just use a data point from the United States. Florida, which locked down in early in the pandemic, but then lifted the lockdowns much earlier, versus California, the age-adjusted mortality from COVID is roughly equivalent, and the all-cause excess deaths, again, age-adjusted, are lower in Florida through the whole pandemic than California. Looking at 2020 alone, it was actually better in Florida than in California. It's not right to just look at 2020. That's cherry-picking. When Anders Tegnell, the Swedish health minister, was asked whether in 2020 whether Sweden picked the right policy, he said, we have to wait a year to see, because the effects of the lockdowns are long and extended. And public health is a long-term thing, not a short-term thing. If you look through the pandemic, you will be hard-pressed to find examples data showing that the lockdowns actually protected people over the long period of time since the pandemic began.
Next question.
Okay, we have heard, and that's part of the debates, anecdotes, cherry-picking, and red herrings. All these small, isolated events. I have a question regarding something much more fundamental. We know that the only thing that stops a respiratory virus disease epidemic is herd immunity. Governors running around and collecting viruses somewhere is not working. And China shows us that even if you take the military to enforce a lockdown, it doesn't work in the long run. So we have to protect the vulnerable as much as we can, and we won't be perfect, while everybody else contributes and takes responsibility for contributing to the build-up of herd immunity. If instead of protecting or providing protection to the vulnerable as much as they want it, we force everybody else to do exactly the same thing that the vulnerable should do to protect themselves or could do to protect themselves, the vulnerable have no advantage anymore, and more of them get infected, and they are the people who die. So of the more than 1 million deaths that we had from COVID, without lockdowns, it may have been 100,000. The question is, I'm sure, the question is, why not focusing on the fundamental principles of epidemiology? Why all these red herrings, cherry picking, and anecdotes?
I think that question is challenging you, Stan, so maybe take it first. Sit down, sir.
There are a lot of serious respiratory diseases. We used to have smallpox. We have influenza every single year. We have respiratory syncytia virus. We have parainfluenza viruses. It goes on and on and on. There's no such thing as flu season. It's really respiratory virus season because there's a whole family of viruses. If you let these go rampant, none of them infects enough of us to achieve herd immunity. It is simply not possible to have that degree of efficiency of transmission. There's only one virus I can think of in which you could saturate a population, kill some of them, but protect everybody, and that's measles. Measles is the one that is so infectious that if we were all susceptible and one of us had measles, half the room would be infected tonight, in just the form that we've had. We used to see children get measles when somebody came into the office at 8 in the morning, was hustled out by the nurse. A child could come in at 10, 11 in the morning and get measles from that child. So with the exception of measles, none of these others is going to achieve herd immunity by simply letting it run rampant. This is one of the failures, I think, of the focused protection concept, that somehow magically we're going to have all the rest of us are going to transmit this relatively benign virus because we're not at risk and we're young and we'll achieve herd immunity. Now that we have a vaccine, we can achieve herd immunity, and in the Northeast, we're coming pretty close. Our circumstances are far more favorable than parts of the country, Mississippi, Wyoming, that are less than 50% vaccinated. We're up in the high 70s in many of the states in the Northeast. However, the Delta and Omicron variants are more infectious than the ancestral strain was. And it may be quite plausible that we need 85-90% coverage to truly achieve herd immunity. We still have one or two patients dying every single day in the Yale New Haven Hospital, most of them unvaccinated. So we still have enough people with 23% unvaccinated. Some of them got COVID, but the immunity is waning. So I couldn't agree with the questioner more that herd immunity is where it's at, but we've got a tremendous public health challenge ahead of us to coax our reluctant friends and colleagues around the country to get vaccinated.
Comment from you, Jay.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of errors in this thinking about how herd immunity actually works. Sten is right about how measles works. If you get measles and recover, you are not going to get it again. You're not going to transmit it again. If you get the vaccine for measles, you are not going to get measles. You're not going to transmit it. That is not true for COVID. You get COVID and recover, you actually have quite good protection, but you are likely to get infected again with less severe disease the second time around. If you get the vaccine, you're going to get COVID. I had the vaccine, two doses in April 2021, and I got COVID in August of 2020. If I asked the room, I bet nearly everyone raised their hands about the vaccinated and getting COVID. So herd immunity through vaccination is a pipe dream. If you think about herd immunity like you think about measles. What you can ask for, what you can expect is a sufficiently large fraction of the population either COVID recovered and or vaccinated, and now you have a relatively protected population, not against disease transmission. This disease is here to stay forever, but against severe disease on infection. And so the notion of herd immunity, this mistake has led to tremendous social harm. For instance, by these vaccine mandates, which came about on the idea that a sufficiently large fraction of the population were vaccinated, the disease essentially would no longer be a danger, with much less transmission. That was not true. As we see from highly vaccinated countries getting severe disease, getting large disease outbreaks over and over again, the problem of very prominent health officials misunderstanding this has led to tremendous distrust in public health and tremendous social harm. But it's a little off topic. It's not exactly about focus protection. So we can talk. But actually, the vaccine should have been used for focus protection. Could have been. Sweden did actually. They vaccinated every dose that they had early on. They used for older people. What it did was, in the spring wave, it decoupled cases from deaths. In the spring wave in 2021 in Sweden, they had only vaccinated maybe 10% of the population, but nearly every single dose went to an old person. And so you had a huge wave of cases and very few deaths per case compared to the winter wave, which was earlier. So I think this is it's a complicated point, but it's led to a lot of mistakes in communication and in policy making.
Quick addition, am I allowed?
Okay.
A lot of people don't understand how vaccines work. So what happens with a vaccine, you're given the antigen that mimics the agent that's out there that's a threat. And so we give you an antigen. Sometimes it's a weakened version of the actual virus. Sometimes a killed version of the virus. Sometimes it's just a viral protein. Sometimes it's a mimic of the virus, but without the DNA material or RNA material in it. So it resembles the surface of the protein. All sorts of different viruses. The mRNA is another example. It doesn't do a spectacular job preventing infection. None of them. We thought hepatitis B vaccine resulted in sterilizing immunity, meaning that it was Dr. Spock and Captain Kirk, and it's like a force shield. No, it's more like you've got the Klingons coming on board, and you know they're coming, so you're prepared to zap them as soon as they land in whatever that machine is where they appear. That's more what vaccines do. They're infection permissive, and the body then sees the antigen and responds very quickly with the what we call anamnestic response. Amnesia, I forgot. Anamnesia, I remembered. So the anamnesia response is how you control it. And even hepatitis B, one of the best vaccines we ever created, when you look at a surgeon or a nurse who has a needle stick, you will see their antibody rise, meaning that person was, in fact, infected. So what Jay says is absolutely right. In this case, we're going to need boosters to minimize the symptomatic infection rate. We're not going to know what the asymptomatic infection rate is, but we don't care. Because if it's asymptomatic, you're not sick, fine. But what we're looking for with high vaccine coverage is essentially herd immunity for hospitalization. We want herd immunity so people don't get hospitalized and die.
Next question.
Hi, my name is David Perella. I'm an interventional neurologist, and I spent the pandemic, at least in March, April, May, in the outer boroughs where I saw a complete collapse of the system. I mean, the day I got to the hospital and my parking spot was gone because two freezer trucks.
And what's your question?
So my question is, I like the idea of focus protection. I think focus protection makes an immense amount of sense in a post-vaccine world. The question that I have is, at what point do we, this is for Dr. Bhattacharya, at what point do you need a lockdown? Because from my perspective, what we were seeing in the outer boroughs of Manhattan was, if you came into the hospital with a large vessel occlusion, if you came in with a trauma, if you came in with an MI, you died. I mean, there's just no way around it. There was an excess mortality because we didn't have the resources there. So while I like the notion of focused protection, for me, I need more of a plan, and I also need to know what that fail-safe would be. Is it an infectious fatality rate? Is it some other metric? Again, we talk about lockdowns, we talk about them universally. What I'm looking at specifically is this initial period. Specifically, it would have been end of March, April, early May, New York City. I think at that point, a lockdown made sense. But I've gotten everything wrong about this virus. You asked me 2 weeks before it happened, I would have been like, don't worry.
So. Question is clear. Jay,
thank you for that question. And thank you for your service during that time. I think the problem is the lockdowns didn't stop those cases from happening. It's not socially possible to have a lockdown that would protect against that what you just described. Because the lockdown, the way the social determinants that Sten's talking about, they apply even during a lockdown. Richer people can protect themselves, can stay home, stay safe. It's a virtue, right? But it's not a virtue because the single mom with their kid is on Zoom, she's a nurse in the hospital, has to make a difficult decision. Poor people can't really lock down. The lockdowns essentially are focused protection of the laptop class instead of focused protection of the vulnerable. The plan for focused protection of the vulnerable first recognize who the vulnerable are and then use local resources to try to protect them. In New York, it would have been really simple to not send COVID-infected patients to nursing homes. Then you would have had many fewer cases and less overwhelmed hospital systems. If you want a detailed plan, you have to ask the local public health authorities to come up with those detailed plans. They're necessarily local in nature. That's why the Great Barrington Declaration is one page. It was a call, an invitation for local public health to engage with that. We now know better, right? We know the lockdowns didn't work to protect the vulnerable. Let's use the new opportunity we have in the meantime to make local plans for that kind of focused protection. The other thing I think, and you highlighted this in your excellent question, the panic itself served no purpose. It created policy lock. It created difficulty in honest discussions with each other so we could learn from each other. I mean, Sten was a big exception to this, where he actually agreed to debate with me twice during the pandemic, which is, I mean, a unique thing. But I couldn't get anyone in my university to debate with me. It was really something else because of the panic. And I think it's hard to say specifically because there's so many different. In Mumbai, it's going to be very different than in LA, than it's going to be in New York, than in Billings or wherever. Every single place, every single local public health authority should be tasked with asking, how would you protect this population that you're responsible for that's living in your area? That should be the focus of public health.
Comment from you, Stan?
I would agree that we had no choice but a lockdown in March, April of 2020 for the reasons that our neurologist friend has articulated. And there is a very interesting, we're learning every day. Papers are coming out every day, new analyses every day. There's one that's out in preprint form now, published in Epidemiology, a respectable journal this year by Jorge Ledesma and colleagues. And they looked at the stringency index for states. how stringent were they in containment and closures? And also they looked at something called a trip ratio, the trips that you took in 2020 compared to what you did in 2019 pre-COVID. And the combination of this stringency index and the trip ratio correlates beautifully with incidence rates. The more efficient the lockdown and the fewer violations of that lockdown, the lower the incidence rates. It's common sense. If everybody in this room is tight and boxed up versus separate, we know from airplane studies and train studies of tuberculosis and flu that it's the people sitting in the adjacent seats on that plane that have astronomical risk of acquiring it during that six-hour flight to LA compared to the people who are sitting a little further away. So it's not that distancing is an arbitrary concept. It's a well-honed concept. Masks are a well-honed concept in public health. And we weren't arbitrarily taking lockdowns and saying, well, we were decompressing society. We were reducing the probability that an infectious individual would encounter a susceptible individual. And that was not irrational, and I think that's exactly what we needed to do. Now, with high vaccine rates, we can be far more liberal. I'm not wearing a mask this evening. I don't see too many masks, because we have balanced assessment of our risks. And given low background incidence rates and given high immunity rates, we have a degree of confidence that if we get COVID, it won't be so serious. Those of you who are not vaccinated, perhaps that doesn't apply to you. But the point is, it's a circumstance where we can start thinking more creatively. And please, Jay, don't say one more time, I've bit my tongue, that somehow sending infected COVID patients back to nursing homes was a reflection of the lockdown strategy. That was just stupid and borderline criminal behavior.
On that, we agree. I have a paper published in the European Journal of Clinical Investigation. It's one of the highly cited papers in this genre of what the lockdown effectiveness is. Turns out that countries, regions that locked down did not actually control the spread, and specifically in terms of shelter-in-place orders and forced business closures, did not actually have lower case spread than countries that did. And in fact, large meta-analyses found that correlation that Sten mentioned doesn't stand up when you do careful causal analysis. You don't have randomized controlled trials, as Sten said, but it's not actually true that the lockdowns were effective in stopping people walking around. It's just not accurate.
That's why Ledesma used the stringency criteria and tried to parse out lockdown versus no lockdown. No, that's not what he's doing.
We were very careful too in that. This is a contentious issue.
Do you think you can make an analysis at a country level, a vast country level,
it wasn't a state level, it wasn't a country level. It was a sub-regional level.
Okay.
Yeah.
We just heard from Sten about criminal behavior in New York State and in Sweden. Let that be a lesson to us all. A final question, I'm afraid, because we're running out of time. What's your final question?
Sten, in your rebuttal to Jay, you said that Sweden adopting the recommendation for social distancing in February or November 2020 was a deviation from focused protection policies. But if I understood Jay correctly, in his earlier rebuttal to you, he said that that policy was completely consistent with focused protection as he defined it. So my question is, do you guys understand what focused protection means or what counts as it and what doesn't in a fundamentally different way?
I'm not going to explain to Jay what focused protection is. He's the author of this concept. As I understand focused protection, let the virus spread among the population. Don't disrupt the economy. Don't disrupt anything. Let it spread among the less vulnerable and try to protect the more vulnerable. That's what I understand focused protection to be.
I'd amend that with one thing. It's not a question of let. Open schools is a good example. Are we letting the virus spread when we open schools? No, we're letting school happen. And the virus may or may not spread. focus protection are policies that are cognizant of who's at high risk and moving resources, ingenuity, and creativity to protect those populations. Anything that does that is focus protection.
That segues into the final part of the evening. I think, unfortunately, no time for your question. Both of these gentlemen are coming to our party afterwards, and you can corner them then with your questions. And they're obviously both...
And you will.
And they're both very approachable. And so 5 minutes of summary from Jay follows by five minutes of summary from Stan. Jay, you can take the podium again.
Thank you, everybody. This is a fantastic night to have these conversations. I want to close by asking not what happened in the past, but what we should do in the future. And I want you to ask yourself honestly: did what we did actually work? We abandoned basic principles of public health in March of 2020. We effectively gave in to panic. We adopted policies that had no empirical basis. Even for instance, 6-foot distancing. There was no study that said 6-foot distancing. We adopted policies that made the population at large fear the disease so much that they didn't invite their in-laws to Thanksgiving or something, or things like that. We basically created a situation where we still think of each other as biohazards. Even asymptomatic people. Is that policy, was it actually constructive? Did it actually lead to good outcomes? 1 million people have died from COVID in the United States at least, many more around the rest of the world. But the policy effects of lockdowns, the harms are actually greater. 100 million people thrown into poverty, that's very bad for health. Tens of millions of people thrown into dire food insecurity, Those are not just simply economic harms. Those are the policy outcomes from the lockdown decision we made, the decision we made to panic the population. The severity of the disease requires a commensurate response. That commensurate response is not lockdown. That commensurate response is a intelligent focus protection. Therefore, going forward, what should we do? I say that what we should do is we should ask public health agencies, if Sten says that there's no plan for local focus protection, make those plans so that we don't tempt it to lock down again. That lockdown policy was a disastrous failure. The school closures, that we both agree, was a tremendously harmful thing. And I think if we decide to not do that, if we decide, okay, that just happened and let's move on, what will happen is we will lock down again. The precedent has been set. And unless we make a conscious decision to not lock down again, we will. I propose to go back to the old plan, the plan that worked before, and actually apply it even in the midst of a difficult pandemic, even in the midst of a pandemic where we're tempted to panic, but we don't. Probably the most important failure of the lockdown was this spread of panic, was essentially the selfish desire to protect ourselves if we could, if we had the resources to do so. We have to go back to a policy that is more humane, a policy that recognizes who's really vulnerable, recognizes that there are people among us that don't have the resources to lock down, recognizes that we're actually interconnected, and that decisions that we make in rich countries have enormous effects, negative effects on poor countries, if we break our promises to them, as we did, the lockdown policy, I think, will go down in history as the single biggest mistake in public health history, a single biggest disaster in public health history. We have to, if we don't, as a community, go back and do an honest assessment of it, we will repeat it again and again forever. And I think I'm glad that this conversation is still happening. It's something that we should ask our elected officials. Let's have a church commission. Let's have an honest assessment, not to put people in jail or whatever for the problems that have been caused, but rather to do an honest assessment of what happened so that we can revise our planning for next time. When in medicine, when a patient dies, there's a conference called a morbidity and mortality conference. people get together, the doctors and nurses and others who are managing the patient that died get together, and sometimes it's a very pointed discussion about what happened. But the goal isn't to blame, but the goal is to learn. And I think I'm delighted that Sten agreed to do this. That's the spirit in which I entered this conversation. I think that's also the spirit that Sten entered it. And I think that's also the spirit in which we as a people need to demand our public health officials, our political officials, to also engage in this discussion, so that when we go forward, we have a better result next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jay. Very articulate. The circumstances of 2020 were unprecedented for 100 years before. We had not seen anything like it, and we responded aggressively with measures that would reduce the efficiency of transmission from person to person. It was an extraordinary time in our history. I hope it'll be the only time in our lives where we experience such a thing. We had no plan for focused protection. We had no investment. We had no workforce. We had no venues. And to say that focused protection would have resulted in fewer dead Americans and worldwide than the lockdowns did, I think, is without an evidence base, conspicuously without an evidence base. I believe that going forward, we are unlikely to see a pandemic threat of the magnitude of what we just saw. The only reason I say that is because we didn't see one for 100 years. On the other hand, when I was a kid, there were 2.4 billion people on Earth. Now there are almost 9 billion. And we're closer and closer to natural populations from whence RNA viruses often spring. It may be that we do see another pandemic in 20 years or 50 years, just as bad as COVID. And I would be pleased if we had nursing home plans in place. I would be pleased if we had proper public health anticipation. It's the ignoring of the 2017 CDC revised pandemic plans by our policymakers that put us in the mess that we found ourselves in 2020. So I think there's a lot of common ground that Jay and I could agree on. But I don't believe that we should buy in to a focused protection plan that is not well crafted, has no specifics attached to it, is reflecting a single page of the Great Barrington and simply saying, public health people, you figure it out. I think there's a lot that we public health people have to figure out. How to protect vulnerable populations is absolutely part of that equation. But to say that we would never do a lockdown again, to me, that is like saying we'll never have a Spanish flu, we'll never have a coronavirus again. I can't say that. We might, in which case we may want to do what we did last time, which is separate us, spread us out as best we can, and reduce the probability of an infectious person encountering a susceptible person, which is fundamental public health principle. Now, I hope we don't have a president who is not encouraging mask use, is encouraging specious drugs that don't work, that is essentially politicizing public health. I think one of the saddest circumstances of this pandemic, other than all the harms that Jay correctly pointed out, is the politicization of public health. I don't think that we need to be politicizing whether the sewage treatment plant isn't working and is polluting our local lake. I don't think we need to be politicizing whether we have lead in our drinking water, as Flint, Michigan had. I don't think we need to be politicizing the need for vaccinating children and adults against vaccine-preventable diseases. There is a huge array of issues in which Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians, Green Party, Red Party, whatever it is, can get together and agree to row the oars in the same direction. I think that's why Jay and I have been doing these debates because the more we see each other, the more we debate our opposing views, the more we do see common ground. And I want to thank him for a very civilized discourse. Thank all of you for coming, and especially thank our organizers. This is an amazing event. I believe in debate. I think that when we don't have enough of it, we make poor decisions. So let's keep debating. Let's keep discussing these issues, and get it right next time. Thank you.
So I have in my hand the SOA Forum Tootsie Roll, which does go to the winner of the Oxford-style debate. Focus protection, as set forth in the Great Barrington Declaration, should be the principle of public health management of highly infectious respiratory virus pandemics. Jane, you've opened the final vote. Vote yes, no, or undecided on the resolution, including those who are watching on live stream. And yeah, so that's the password to get into the app on that. And I guess what you want to throw up the Brent, you want to throw up the promotion of the swag we're selling while you're voting. We do look for the raising of funds to finance these operations. Amazingly enough, your ticket sales and even some of the contributions that have been made are not enough for us to step up certain efforts, which we want to step up next year. And so we will be selling swag, SOA Forum swag, which is it's bags, it's whatever else. And I guess we're not throwing up the swag, much to my happiness, because all of it features caricature of me, and I did not request it. I did not know anything about what Jay. This is the first time I'm actually seeing it this evening. It was not a decision that I made, but I told Jane and Brett and the others that I guess they had a better sense of what people would want to buy. I personally can't imagine that anybody would want to buy this stuff. But apparently I've been told I'm wrong, and it is true that it does bring in money if you buy it, and apparently. And it has been regarded as obviously a favorable representation. Does me honor the particular look, and it does relate to my most embarrassing moment as a debater. I did debate a young man who was a socialist, and I did tell him to learn some economics, and I got and I got quite annoyed with him. Unlike these two guys on this stage, who've been quite polite to each other, I did get rather rude to that young man. And I've never been able to live it down. Certainly not been able to live it down with my staff. And so they want to haunt me with that. Learn some economics. The mug. What is it? The mug. The sock. The notebook. My God, you can't do without any of this stuff. The indoor pillow. And it's all going to be on sale. It is what you can buy it right now. Jane, is that correct? Yeah, you can go on our website and buy it right now. Yeah, and while we're voting, however, I also want to make an announcement about next month's debate. That's going to be Wednesday, December 14th, again in this hall, and we're going to get National Review Editor-in-Chief Richard Lowry to come to our hall. Even more of an honor than getting Sten Verman, my God. And he will defend the resolution very different. Nationalism is an important value that Americans should support. That will be defended by National Review Editor-in-Chief Richard Lowry. And taking the negative will be Cato Institute Senior Fellow Alex Narasta. And then also next year, we're going to institute a new initiative that I'm going to be talking about later in the week. And those who will be invited to the initiative initially will be those who are on our Facebook page. The Facebook page is called what again, Jane? It's called, I keep forgetting it's that. What? SOA Forum Inner Circle. If you go on the SOA Forum Inner Circle and become a member, then you can get first dibs to be a part of our new initiative, which I'm only going to outline once I write it to the Inner Circle. Our donors will be invited, as well as our volunteers, on the initial phase to come in to that new initiative that's starting in January. And that's going to cost us money. We believe we can afford it. It will help very much if you make a contribution by, for example, buying some of this ugly swag. And on Thursday, January 26th, we are going to have a debate on the Federal Reserve. George Mason University Professor of Economics, Lawrence White, will defend the resolution replacing the Federal Reserve with free market institutions would significantly improve the economy's money, banking, and financial systems. And arguing against that resolution will be Columbia University Professor of Banking and Financial Institutions, Lawrence Mishkin. So that's January 26th. And how are we doing on the voting, Jane? We're still coming in? Yeah.
We're ready to close.
Oh, ready to close. Okay. Drum roll, please, as Jane brings it up to me, and I hold in my hand the Soa Form Tootsie Roll. And then also, again, I know where, follow me, particularly Sten, you don't know, it's two blocks uptown. Please follow me, Sten, to the refreshments at our place, and when you can meet and greet. And Jay, you did a little interview at our place this morning. So follow Jay, because he knows where the place is. And so here we have the results. Drum roll, please. The yes on the resolution began at 56.7%, and it went to 81%, picking up 24 points. So that's the number to beat. Sten, you did pick up votes of 8 points, but 24 points pick up for the resolution means that Jay Bhattacharya gets the Tootsie Roll. Congratulations to you both.